When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 25 of The Renaissance and the Reformation by Emmeline Tanner. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 4, Chapter 16, The Revolt in the Netherlands, Part 1. When the Netherlands passed to Charles, the grandson of the Emperor Maximilian and Mary of Burgundy in 1506, they were a collection of 17 provinces, duchies, lordships, counties, and municipalities, each with its own peculiar government, and bound to one another by no tie except that of acknowledging a common sovereign. The various provinces were inhabited by people differing in race and language, in interests and sentiment. The Dutchmen of the north lived chiefly by fishing and maritime commerce. The Flemings of the center and the French-speaking Walloons of the south by manufactures, trading, and agriculture. The provinces were prosperous. Their cities vied with those of Italy in industry and intelligence, and Antwerp was said to be the great harbor and emporium for the trade of the European world. Charles V, following the policy of the time, endeavored to form a central government and make the loosely united and scattered provinces into a compact state. He extended his boundaries by securing Friesland in 1515, Overijssel in 1528, Groningen in 1536, Gilders and Zutphen in 1543, and the temporal sovereignty over the ecclesiastical province of Utrecht in 1527. By the Treaty of Madrid, 1526, Flanders, Artois, and Tournai were freed from French sovereignty. Charles was not successful in the southeast. He could neither buy nor conquer the independent principality of Lorraine, which lay between Luxembourg and Franche-Comté. In 1548 the Netherlands were organized as the Burgundian Circle, though they retained their independence of imperial taxation and jurisdiction. A representative States-General united the provinces into one principality, and all provincial courts were made subject to a supreme court of justice established at Mechelen. Another difficulty in governing the Netherlands arose from the fact that the ecclesiastical and the territorial divisions did not coincide. At the accession of Philip II in 1555, there were only four sees, Arras, Utrecht, Tournai, and Cambrai, and these were too large to be satisfactorily administered. The other parts of the Netherlands were under the jurisdiction of foreign bishops, and all were subject to foreign archbishops. Charles had proposed to reform this by the establishment of six new bishoprics, but the papal court had opposed his plans, and he had not time to put them into effect. The inhabitants of the Low Countries had always been obliged to struggle against the sea. Much of their land had been originally won and retained only by unceasing efforts. The necessity of constantly overcoming difficulties had made the people hard-working, persevering, and determined, and the possession of these characteristics was undoubtedly one of the chief causes of their material prosperity. Their mental condition was equally prosperous. The excellent schools of the Brethren of the Common Lot had been established in different parts of the country, and many famous humanists, among them Erasmus, the prince of them all, belonged to the Netherlands. The education of the people in the schools of the Brethren, where the foundation of all teaching was the gospel of Christ, prepared their minds for the Reformation movement. Tracts against indulgences were in circulation in the Low Countries before Luther fastened his 95 theses to the church door at Wittenberg, and evangelical teaching had begun to spread through the land. Many translations of the Bible or of the New Testament into Dutch, Flemish, or French being made between 1513 and 1531. Luther's writings became widely known and read, and Charles V issued proclamations against his books. The edicts, called placards, increased in severity, and in 1550, after the issue of one which threatened death to all heretics or harborers of heretics, the Inquisition was established in the Netherlands. Charles was never allowed to appoint one inquisitor general who should have uncontrolled power to enforce the edicts, but by his board of ecclesiastical judges he set himself to crush heresy in the provinces, and many men and women gave their lives for their faith. The Reformed faith spread, however, and the regents, Margaret of Austria, 1506-30, and Mary of Hungary, 1530-55, were not always very strict in enforcing the edicts. In spite of his policy of centralization, his severe religious edicts, and his continual demand for money, Charles V was popular in the Netherlands, the land of his birth. He loved the people and was loved by them. Except in religious matters, he was too cautious to excite any general opposition, and the provinces were prosperous under his rule. The ceremony of the emperor's abdication in the great hall of the Palace of Brussels, October 25, 1555, when ruler and subjects were all overcome with emotion, is one of the most touching in history. On that occasion, Philip II might have won a place in the hearts of his new subjects, but he could not speak their language, and he lost his opportunity. Philip continued his father's policy, but he at once roused opposition. He left the country in 1559, never to return, and in that same year his half-sister Margaret of Parma became regent. The powers of the regent were nominally great, but she was directed to rule by the advice of three councils, of which the Council of State, where the great nobles had seats, was the chief. There was, however, a small committee, the Consulta, which, following Philip's instructions, destroyed the influence of the council. It consisted of the Bishop of Arras, Cardinal de Granvelle, Barlaymont, a Flemish noble, and Vilius, a lawyer. The government by Margaret and the Consulta alienated all classes. The nobles were irritated at being ignored. The people were alarmed at the disregard of their liberties. The institution of a number of new bishoprics and their organization under three archbishops, Mechlin, Cambrai, Utrecht, was very unpopular, for clergy and people alike feared that the episcopal power would lead to an increase in the severity of the Inquisition. The Reformation movement still made progress. The teachings of Calvin had been introduced during the latter part of Charles V's reign, and these appealed to the Netherlanders more than the Lutheran doctrines. Philip, however, was determined to extirpate heresy altogether. "I would lose all my states and 100 lives if I had them," he wrote, "rather than be the lord of heretics." The opposition to the government was led by three great nobles, William of Nassau, Prince of Orange, Count Egmont, and Admiral Horn. William of Nassau, 1533-84, was born at his father's castle in the county of Nassau on April 25, 1533. At the age of 11, he inherited the vast possessions of his cousin René, which included much land in the Netherlands and the Principality of Orange on the Rhône, the latter carrying with it the title of Sovereign Prince of the Empire. William's parents were Lutherans, but after his cousin René's death, they allowed him to be brought up as a Catholic at the court of Brussels. Charles V took a great interest in the boy, his favorite page, who, under the tuition of the brother of Granvelle, made rapid progress, speaking and writing with ease in five languages, Flemish, German, Spanish, French, and Latin. William was entrusted with military command at an early age, and was employed on diplomatic missions in which he was particularly successful. At the famous ceremony of abdication, Charles entered the hall leaning on the arm of his young favorite, whom he had appointed stadtholder of Holland, Zeeland, Utrecht, and West Friesland. William was one of the plenipotentiaries sent to arrange the terms of the Treaty of Cateau-Cambrésis, and he was afterwards one of the state hostages, Count Egmont and the Duke of Alva and Aerschot being the others, who went to Paris to guarantee the carrying out of the terms of the peace. While there he became aware of the secret agreement between the kings of France and Spain to stamp out heresy from their dominions by fire and sword. William was still nominally, at any rate, a Catholic, but he determined that henceforth he would do his best to drive this Spanish vermin from the land. It was at this time that the prince won the nickname of Le Taciturne, the Silent, because of his habitual discretion. The title is apt to give a wrong impression of a man who was the most affable and gracious of men, brilliant in speech and famous for his charm of manner, of which it was said later that every time he put off his hat, he won a subject from the King of Spain. In 1561, much against the wishes of Philip and Granvelle, William married Anne, daughter of Maurice of Saxony, and a granddaughter of the Landgrave Philip of Hesse. Count Egmont, 1522-68, also belonged to a distinguished family, and possessed great estates in the Netherlands. He won renown in the battles of Saint-Quentin, 1557, and Gravelines, 1558, and Philip appointed him stadtholder of Brabant and Artois. His fine presence, genial manner, and military success made him very popular. To the end, he remained a sincere Catholic and a loyal subject of the king. Philip de Montmorency, Count Van Horn, and Admiral of Flanders, 1518-68, was a count of the Holy Roman Empire. He had staked much property in the service of Charles and Philip. He served with distinction at Saint-Quentin, and in 1559 accompanied Philip to Spain. On his return to the Netherlands in 1561, he was made a member of the Council of State. In 1563, these three nobles wrote to Philip demanding the dismissal of Granvelle, and they declined to appear at the council until their request was granted. In 1564, Philip very reluctantly dismissed his minister, but he made no change in his policy. In August, on his sole authority, he ordered the publication and enforcement of the edicts of the Council of Trent in the Netherlands. This drew forth a protest from Catholics and Protestants alike, as it was a serious invasion of the privileges of the provinces. In 1565, Count Egmont was sent to Spain to urge upon the king the necessity of calling the States General and of reforming the Council of State and admitting more native noblemen as counselors. He was well received by Philip and magnificently entertained, but he was quite deceived as to the king's intentions. The letter he carried back to the council destroyed all hopes of the nobles. No change was to be made in the administration. The States General was not to be summoned, and the edicts against heretics were to be strictly enforced. The decrees of Trent were to be published immediately in Philip's name. The regent remonstrated and implored her brother to moderate his orders, but he merely reiterated the command to execute the edicts. From the receipt of the first letter, William of Orange declared that it was useless further to try to persuade the king. He called on the council to publish the proclamation and is said to have whispered to his neighbor, "Now we shall see the curtain rise on a fine tragedy." The proclamation roused wild indignation and excitement, and magistrates refused to execute the edicts, which would compel them to burn more than 60,000 of their fellow countrymen. Foreign merchants fled. Thousands of skilled workmen left the Netherlands. Trade ceased, and hundreds of pamphlets appealing to the people to put an end to the tyranny were distributed through the land and eagerly read. For the first time, the lesser nobility began to take an active part in the opposition. They were led by Louis of Nassau, the brave, reckless, chivalrous, and God-fearing young brother of William, by the learned Philip von Marnix, Lord of St. Aldegonde, a Calvinist, who had no more idea of toleration than the king himself, and by the dissipated Henry, Viscount de Brederode. In November 1565, on the day of the marriage of Alexander of Parma with Maria of Portugal, when Brussels was gay with the wedding festivities, a number of young nobles met together to hear a sermon by a Calvinist missionary preacher. At this meeting and others afterwards, they decided to form a confederacy of nobles. In a document called the Compromise, they bound themselves to unite in resisting the Inquisition, which evil counselors, mostly foreigners, had induced the king to establish in the country in violation of his oath. At the same time, they protested their loyalty. About 500 of the lesser nobility and a number of burghers joined the league. The greater nobles took no part in it. In April 1566, the Confederates presented a petition to the regent asking for the abolition of the placards and the Inquisition and the assembling of the States General. They made an imposing demonstration as they marched through the streets to the palace amid the acclamations of the populace, and the Duchess was somewhat dismayed. Barlaymont, however, reassured her with the famous words, "Madam, is your highness afraid of these beggars? C'est que?" The next day, at a banquet of 300 of the Confederates, when they were discussing a name for the league, de Brederode arose and said, "They call us beggars. Let us adopt the name. We will resist the Inquisition, but we will remain true to the king and to the beggar's wallet." From that time, the party of opposition was known as the Beggars. Meanwhile, the regent sent envoys to Philip, urging him to abolish the Inquisition and summon the States General to moderate the edicts. The apparent success of the Confederates encouraged the people. Refugees returned in great numbers. Missionaries of the Reformed faith appeared all over the country and preached to the people in the woods, in villages, and even on the outskirts of great towns. The Confederates held another meeting and presented a second petition to the regent, in which they hinted that unless the persecution was mitigated, they would appeal to force. Philip now sent a dispatch promising to withdraw the Inquisition, but refusing to summon the States General. At this time, however, a general insurrection broke out, 1566-7. The opposition spread to the lower classes, and the people went mad. Churches were invaded, images thrown down, colored windows broken, and manuscripts and books destroyed. The beautiful cathedral of Antwerp was sacked and its richest treasures destroyed. Many of the rioters came from the dregs of the population. These fanatical scenes did more harm than anything else to the cause of the Reformation. They alienated the Roman Catholics, many of whom had previously joined the League, and they shocked all moderate men. The regent wished to flee from Brussels, but William of Orange advised her to remain, and when she had made certain concessions, the great nobles supported her in crushing the rebellion. Afterwards, Margaret, enraged by the insurrection, took advantage of the reaction it caused and withdrew all the privileges she had granted, and raised troops in the Catholic provinces to overawe the towns which she could least trust. End of section 25. Section 26 of The Renaissance and the Reformation by Emmeline Tanner. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 4, Chapter 16, The Revolt in the Netherlands, Part 2. The news of the outrages infuriated Philip, and he determined to revenge himself not only on the rebels, but upon the great nobles. William of Orange, always well informed through his agents at Madrid, unable to persuade Egmont and Horn to resist by force of arms, retired to his estates in Germany, April 1567. He escaped just in time, for shortly afterwards the Duke of Alva, the hangman of the Netherlands, bigoted, cruel, and determined, arrived in Brussels with a fine army of Spaniards and Italians. Philip had granted him such extensive powers that the regent's authority became merely nominal, and soon after she left the Netherlands. Alva at once introduced garrisons into the chief towns, and luring Egmont and Horn to his residence, he suddenly arrested and imprisoned them. No court existed that could execute summary justice on these prisoners, so by the mere fiat of his will, Alva created one. It was called the Council of Tumults, but was popularly known as the Council of Blood. Its decisions were to override those of any other court, and it was to be responsible to none. The council began its sittings on September 20th, 1567. Thousands of people were brought before it from every part of the land, and they were condemned in batches, sometimes as many as 80 or 90 at a time. Alva wrote to Philip that more than 1,500 were taken in their beds on Ash Wednesday morning and added, "I have ordered all of them to be executed." He is said afterwards to have boasted that during the period of his rule, 1567 to 73, he executed 18,600 persons. Thousands of people left the country. Granvelle estimated that 60,000 went to England alone, and more to Germany. Meanwhile, the proceedings against Egmont and Horn dragged on. William of Orange was declared an outlaw if he did not submit himself for trial before the Council of Tumults, and his eldest son, a boy of 15, was kidnapped from the University of Louvain and carried off to Spain, 1568. William now published his justification, in which he declared that as one of the sovereign princes of Europe, he would not be summoned before a tribunal which had no jurisdiction over him. The document is an account of the events in the Netherlands and an arraignment of Philip. It was published in several languages and distributed through Europe. A change had come over the character of William. Previously, somewhat indifferent to religion, he had been moved by the sufferings of his countrymen to study the Holy Scriptures, and the Reformed doctrine had taken hold of him. He believed he was God's instrument to rescue his persecuted people, and he made preparations for an armed opposition. With difficulty, he collected an army and was ready by the end of April 1568. He arranged for a threefold attack on the Netherlands. In May, his brother Louis defeated the Spaniards in Heiligerlee, but otherwise the campaign was a failure. Alva was roused to fury by the reverse. In spite of the protests of the emperor and the German princes, he executed Egmont and Horn, June 5th, 1568, in the marketplace at Brussels, and then at the head of a magnificent army, marched against Louis of Nassau, whom he defeated at the Battle of Jemmingen, July 21st. William himself now advanced into Brabant, but Alva avoided an engagement, and the expedition was a failure. "We may regard the prince now as a dead man," wrote Alva to Philip. "He has neither influence nor credit. They are broken, famished, cut to pieces." The Netherlanders were overawed by Alva's reign of terror. They were slow to move, and William's action was premature. An overwhelming opposition was preparing, however. The execution of Egmont and Horn had roused the national feeling of the people, and Alva himself raised the storm by a ruinous scheme of taxation. In 1569 he proposed to levy a tax of 1% on all property, another of 5% on every sale of landed property, and one of 10% upon every sale of goods. Such a scheme was preposterous for a commercial nation. In 1571, Alva attempted to enforce it. His attempt aroused a storm of opposition. The shops were closed, businesses were suspended, and trade and manufactures came to a standstill. According to contemporaries, the brewers would not brew, the bakers would not bake, the tavern keepers would not tap their beer. Even Alva was obliged to acknowledge himself beaten. Many of the exiles had taken refuge on the sea, where they were little better than pirates, attacking the Spaniards and other Papists. They were dreaded by friends and foes alike. Acting on the advice of Admiral Coligny, William had furnished these men with an organization, but he found it impossible to enforce discipline. On April 1, 1572, these sea beggars, as they were called, under William de la Marck, seized Brille, a fortified town on Verne, which was then an island in the mouth of the Maas. The people were compelled to take an oath of allegiance to William as stadtholder under the king, and the flag, which was the symbol of a new sea power, on that day born into the world, was hoisted for the first time. Town after town, especially in the provinces of Holland and Zeeland, rose and declared for the stadtholder, William of Orange. The French court, now under the influence of Coligny, promised to help the Netherlanders, and Elizabeth, who had previously confined her assistance to permitting the English sailors to attack Spanish ships, sent money to William of Orange. Louis of Nassau took Mons, May 24th, and on July 15th, 1572, deputies from the states of Holland, Zeeland, Friesland, and Utrecht, while still acknowledging the authority of Philip, recognized William as stadtholder. The prince had already set out from Germany to raise the southern provinces when the news of the massacre of St. Bartholomew reached him. No help could now be expected from France. "What a sledgehammer blow that has been," William wrote to his brother. "My only hope was from France." Mons had to be abandoned, and on September 19th, Louis of Nassau was obliged to capitulate. The terms of the capitulation were violated by Alva, and Mons was cruelly treated. Mechlin and Zutphen were scenes of terrible bloodshed, but in spite of this, other towns in the northern provinces held out. The Spaniards besieged Haarlem for 7 months, December 1572, to July 1573, before they could take it, and when at last the citizens surrendered, 2,000 were murdered in cold blood, and their bodies, tied two and two together, were cast into Haarlem Lake. The nation of fishermen and shopkeepers, once the scorn of Spain and of Europe for their patient endurance of indignities, were seen at last to be a race of heroes, determined never again to endure the yoke of the Spaniard. The Spanish soldiers mutinied, the Spanish fleet was defeated by the Dutch sailors, and Alva asked for his recall. On November 17, 1573, he was succeeded by Don Luis de Requesens, a distinguished general from the higher Spanish nobility, high-minded and of a generous disposition. Had he been sent earlier, the revolt of the Netherlands might never have taken place. He reversed Alva's policy, dissolved the Council of Blood, and tried to win back the provinces by conciliation. William, however, refused to make terms on any condition that did not include the promise of freedom of conscience, the restoration of the ancient charters, and the withdrawal of Spaniards from all posts, civil and military. The war continued, and still the Netherlanders were always victorious at sea, but were defeated in land battles. In February 1574, the sea beggars took Middelburg, and thus became masters of the whole island of Walcheren. But in April at Mugerheide, Louis of Nassau and his brother Henry were defeated and slain. Leyden, which had been besieged since November 1573, still held out, though there seemed no hope for it after the defeat of Louis's army. William suggested to the Estates of Holland that they should cut the dikes and let in the sea. "It is better to ruin the land than to lose it," he said. His advice was followed, but contrary winds prevented the waters from rising high enough to reach Leyden. At last, on October 3rd, after 4 months of terrible suspense and suffering, the inhabitants watched the fleet of the beggars sail on the incoming tide to the walls of the city. The Spaniards fled, the beggars entered, and the rescued people went to the church to offer thanksgiving for their deliverance. But the singing suddenly came to an end, and nothing was heard but low weeping. The long-expected relief was too much for the overwrought people. At William's suggestion, the University of Leiden was founded in commemoration of the relief. In 1575, Requesens once more attempted negotiations, but they were useless, for Philip would concede nothing more than permission to the Protestants to sell their possessions and leave the country. The next year the regent died suddenly. The Spanish soldiers, angry at their want of pay, mutinied in July, and for 3 days sacked Antwerp, November 4th to 7th, 1576. They massacred thousands of people and burnt some of the finest buildings. On November 8th, delegates from all the provinces, Protestant and Roman Catholic, signed the pacification of Ghent, whereby they agreed that while still acknowledging the authority of Philip, all should combine to drive the Spanish soldiers out of the land, and that the States General should be summoned. The Prince of Orange was to be governor of the 17 provinces and Admiral General of Holland and Zeeland. The edicts against heresy were to be suspended, but no attack was to be made upon Catholic religion. Meanwhile, Don John of Austria had arrived as regent, November 1576 to 1578. But he was not allowed to make his state entry into Brussels until he had, by the perpetual edict, confirmed the pacification, February 1577. When in the city, he found himself regent only in name. "The Prince of Orange," he wrote to the king, "has bewitched the minds of all men." In 1578, Philip sent the young Alexander of Parma, the best general and the wisest statesman he had employed in the Netherlands, with a large army to assist Don John. This army defeated the patriots at Gembloux, January 31st, 1578. Parma and Don John now did all they could to foment the difference between northern and southern provinces, between Protestants and Roman Catholics. In July, the Catholics invited Francis, Duke of Anjou, to become defender of the liberties of the Netherlands, and William felt it politic not to oppose the invitation. But at the same time he secured the alliance of Queen Elizabeth and Henry of Navarre. Don John died in October, and Parma, who became regent, was successful in widening the breach between the provinces. William began to realize that a union of the whole 17 provinces was impossible. On January 5th, 1579, a defensive league was signed at Arras between the provinces of Hainaut, Douai, and Artois for the protection of the Roman Catholic religion and with the ultimate intention of a reconciliation with Spain. On January 29th, the northern provinces of Holland, Zeeland, Utrecht, Gelderland, and Zutphen formed the Union of Utrecht, binding themselves as one province to defend their rights against all foreign potentates, including the King of Spain. These two leagues mark the definite separation of the Romanist South from the Protestant North and the creation of a new Protestant state, the United Provinces. In June 1580, William published the Ban Against William of Orange. He was denounced as an enemy of the human race, and all loyal subjects were forbidden to give him food, drink, or fire. 25,000 crowns, immunity from punishment for any crime, and a patent of nobility was promised to any who should deliver this pest to us, dead or alive, or take his life. Shortly after, William answered in his famous apology, which is an account of his whole career and a scathing denunciation of Philip. It was translated into several languages and sent to all the courts of Europe. On July 26th, 1581, by the act of abjuration, the representatives of Brabant, Flanders, Utrecht, Gelderland, Holland, and Zeeland solemnly renounced their allegiance to the King of Spain. William felt that the new Commonwealth was not strong enough to stand alone. He therefore used all his influence to persuade Francis, Duke of Anjou, to accept the sovereignty. He knew the Duke was weak and dissipated, but hoped to be able to control him. As the heir of France and the suitor of Elizabeth, Anjou seemed to the prince a means of obtaining two powerful kingdoms. In February 1582, Anjou finally accepted the sovereignty. He was not a success, however. He was jealous of William's influence, and he disliked the restraints which were placed upon him. He endeavored to make himself master by a coup d'état in January 1583. He succeeded in occupying some towns, but at Antwerp his attempt caused the citizens to resist, and nearly 2,000 of his troops were massacred in the French fury. Parma was now successful in recovering nearly all of the central provinces except Brabant. Anjou left for France in June and died there a year later, June 1584. Already since the publication of Philip's ban, several attempts had been made to assassinate William, and on July 10, 1584, a Roman Catholic fanatic, Balthazar Gérard, contrived to shoot him at Delft. The prince fell with the words, "My God, have pity on my soul and on this poor people." At the age of 51, the greatest man the struggle had produced thus passed away. He was the one great leader who rose above the religious differences of the time and strove for toleration in its broadest sense. Having no strong religious feelings in his youth, but living as a consistent Roman Catholic until 1555, he gradually changed and publicly declared himself a Calvinist in 1573. Possessing great talents as well as great ambition and a love of power, he was able to curb his passions and keep them in control, content to be the defender of his country and declining to be her ruler. Yet though cut off with his task unfinished, William the Silent had really done his work. The foundations of that mighty Dutch Republic, which will ever be inseparably connected with his name, were already laid so strong and deep that on them men of his blood, successive princes of Orange, scarcely less great than he, were able to build up the edifice of a worldwide commercial and colonial empire. William left two men very capable of carrying on his work. Maurice, his second son, a born general, though now only a youth of 17, was at once made captain general and stadtholder of Holland and Zeeland, and afterwards in 1590 of Gelderland, Utrecht, and Overijssel. Maurice did not care for politics, but John van Oldenbarnevelt, the pensionary of Rotterdam, a wise statesman, was well able to guide the politics of the United Provinces through the difficult time that followed. Immediately after the death of William, however, foreign assistance was a necessity. Parma was gaining continued success in the south. The Netherlanders offered the sovereignty to Henry III of France, but at the command of the League, he declined the honor, July 1585. Unable to get help from the French, the people turned to England, and in December 1585, Elizabeth at last openly sent assistance by dispatching a body of troops under the Earl of Leicester. At the same time, she declined the sovereignty of the Netherlands. A little later, this was offered to Leicester, who accepted it without consulting the Queen, to Elizabeth's great indignation. The new governor was successful neither as general nor as statesman. He had many difficulties to contend with because of the various parties and factions in the provinces, and his Calvinistic prejudices led him to renounce altogether William the Silent's policy of toleration. While under his command, the Patriots suffered many disasters, including the failure to take Zutphen in October 1586, when Sir Philip Sidney fell. In the following year, Elizabeth, who had already forgiven Leicester, recalled her favorite and threw all the blame of the failure upon the Dutch. In reality, she herself was partly responsible, for she refused to send sufficient supplies and never threw herself heartily into the cause of the Allies, hoping by this means to be in a position to negotiate satisfactory terms between them and Philip. The Spanish king, however, was now determined to attack England. Parma earnestly recommended that he should first make a serious attempt, finally, to conquer the United Provinces, but his advice was not regarded. Mary, Queen of Scots, died in 1587, leaving to Philip all her claim to the crown of England, and in May 1588 the Great Armada sailed. Parma, the most competent of all the generals of Spain, was prevented by the Netherlanders from cooperating on England. The defeat of the Armada ruined Spain, destroyed her supremacy on the sea, and made the reconquest of the United Provinces an impossibility. Before his death in 1592, however, Parma had reduced the southern provinces to complete obedience. He had also, by his assistance to the Catholics, 1589-92, postponed the triumph of Henry of Navarre in France. Meanwhile, Maurice had won many successes, and these continued after the death of Parma. Eventually, in 1609, a 12 years truce between the United Provinces and Spain practically acknowledged the independence of the former, though the formal recognition was not made till 1648. The new Commonwealth had internal difficulties to contend with, many of them caused by the rivalry between the provincial and central authorities. But these did not affect her prosperity. Her commerce prospered. She won a great colonial empire, and for a time was mistress of the seas. The science, art, and literature of the Dutch gave them a high rank also among the civilized nations of the world. Very different was the condition of the Spanish Netherlands, where the cities that at the beginning of the struggle had been as wealthy and prosperous as any in Europe were now like cities of the dead, their industries neglected, their trade gone. It was long before these provinces regained their energy and vitality. End of section 26. Section 27 of The Renaissance and the Reformation by Emmeline Tanner. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 4, Chapter 17. The Wars of Religion in France and the Reign of Henry IV, Part 1. A. The Reformation and the Formation of Parties. The beginning of the Reformation in France was especially closely connected with the Renaissance. It was in no sense a national movement, working upward from the people as in Germany, nor was it guided and controlled by the sovereign as in England. It began with a group of humanists who desired to reconcile the truths of Christianity with the new learning, to study the scriptures at first hand, and preach Christ from the sources. These men had no thought of revolution. The Reformation they desired was to be carried on within the church by the church itself. The leader of the early reformers was Jacques Lefebvre of Etaples, a distinguished humanist who preached the doctrine of justification by faith in the notes to his new Latin translation of the epistles of St. Paul as early as 1512. He revised a former French translation of the Bible, publishing the New Testament in 1523 and the Old Testament 2 years later. A pupil of Lefebvre's, Guillaume Brissonnet, became bishop of Meaux in 1516 and gathered round him a number of earnest and religious humanists, including Lefebvre himself and Guillaume Farel of Dauphiné, who became known as the Group of Meaux. Brissonnet was the spiritual director of Francis I's sister, the pure and enthusiastic Margaret of Angoulême, whose court was always a center and a refuge for humanists and reformers. Footnote: Margaret was born at Angoulême in 1492. She married the Duke of Alençon in 1509, and after being a widow for 2 years, married Henri d'Albret, King of Navarre, in 1527. She died in 1549 and left one child, Jean d'Albret, the mother of Henry of Navarre. Back to main text. The writings of Luther were quickly circulated and much read in France, but the ideas of Zwingli seem to have appealed more to the advanced French thinkers. In 1521, the Sorbonne, the theological faculty in the University of Paris, formally condemned Luther's writings and in the same year the Parlement of Paris ordered his book to be given up. Footnote. The Parlement were the highest courts of justice in France, the Parlement of Paris being by far the most important of them. Back to main text. Francis I warmly sympathized with the Renaissance, though he had no comprehension of the deeper Reformation movement, and this sympathy, combined with the influence of his sister, inclined him at first to protect the reformers. Consequently, when the library of Louis de Berquin, a gentleman of Picardy, was seized and many of his books publicly burnt by order of the Parlement in 1523, Berquin himself was saved by the king. Later, however, the complications of foreign policy and the extravagance of fanatics among the reforming parties caused Francis to become more and more intolerant. During her son's captivity in Madrid, Louise of Savoy, the queen mother, joined with the Parlement in an effort to crush heresy. In July 1525, a wool carder named Jean Leclerc was burned at Metz for an outrage on images. In October, Brissenet was ordered to disperse the preachers of Meaux. In the following January, Berquin was imprisoned, and in February a young man named Joubert was burned at Paris. During this time, too, many other persons were arrested, and Lefebvre's translation of the New Testament was publicly burned. The king returned from captivity in March, and at first showed favor to the reformers, ordering the Parlement to set Berquin at liberty and appointing Lefebvre himself tutor to his youngest son. In May 1528, however, some revolutionary spirits in Paris mutilated a statue of the Virgin. This action enraged the king, and Berquin being again brought to trial a little later, Francis refused to interfere, and the reformer was burnt, April 1529. The king, being desirous of obtaining the alliance of the Pope and the pecuniary support of the French clergy, adopted a policy of persecution which was continued until 1532, when he entered into negotiations with the Protestant princes of Germany and consequently relaxed the persecutions in France. Once more, the rashness of fanatics destroyed the hopes of the more moderate reformers. On October 18th, 1534, the walls of the principal streets of Paris were covered with placards attacking the mass and its celebrants in coarse and offensive language. The king was furious, and a religious persecution began. Various edicts against heretics were issued and promptly and rigorously enforced, and the fires of persecution were soon kindled all over France. In 1545, some 3,000 of the Waldenses of Provence were massacred, and 22 of their villages destroyed, and in the following year, 14 artisans belonging to the newly organized Reformed Church at Meaux, the 14 of Meaux, were executed after undergoing what was known as extraordinary torture. By this time, Protestants were to be found in every province of France except Brittany. The result of the persecution was to drive many into exile and to intimidate others into outwardly conforming with the church. On the other hand, the steadfastness with which men died for the new faith and the purity of the lives of its adherents did more than anything else to add to the number of converts. Moreover, refugees from Geneva and Strasbourg came back to France, filled with the desire to spread the evangelical doctrines, even at the risk of their lives. From one part of the land to another, they crept along the great roads and waterways, often changing their names to escape detection, and meeting their followers at night in fields, in cellars, or in the houses of quiet suburbs. French Protestantism had been only slightly affected by the influence of Luther. The Reformation in France was a more or less independent movement, based directly upon the study of scriptures, and in the earlier years had no organization. Almost from the time of the publication of the Institutes of the Christian Religion in 1536, however, it was guided and controlled by Calvin, the great Frenchman whom few except his countrymen have been able thoroughly to understand and appreciate. From Geneva, Calvin wrote continually to the French Protestants, solving their difficulties, exhorting and encouraging and inspiring them. When in 1555 they began to organize their churches, they used as a model that founded at Strasbourg by their leader, and in the following years the organization of churches in all parts of France was carried on under the supervision of the reformer of Geneva. In 1547, Francis I was succeeded by his son, Henry II, 1547-59, and the persecution of the Protestants became more rigorous than before. A special chamber of the Parlement was created for the trial of heretics, October 1547. It was known as La Chambre Ardente from the number of victims it sent to the stake. The Edict of Chateaubriand, June 1551, aimed at uniting all the forces of the kingdom, clerical and lay, in a great effort to extirpate heresy. An attempt to introduce the Inquisition into France in 1557 was, however, successfully opposed by the Parlement. This opposition marks the beginning of a reaction against the severe persecution of the Protestants. By this time, there were at least 300,000 Huguenots in France. Footnote. The name given to French Protestants. It was first applied to the Protestants in Geneva, and may be a corruption of the German Eidgenossen, Confederates. Back to main text. They belonged mostly to the classes of the burghers and tradesmen, and the lesser nobility. But at the end of Henry II's reign they were joined by men and women from the higher ranks of society, notably Admiral Coligny and his brother François d'Andelot, and the two Bourbon brothers, Antony, King of Navarre, in the right of his wife Jeanne, and Louis, Prince of Condé. Protestantism never appealed to the lower classes in France. The Huguenots, therefore, were always in a minority in the kingdom. On July 10, 1559, Henry II died, having been mortally wounded in a tournament held to commemorate the Peace of Cateau-Cambrésis. He left four sons, all somewhat weak in intellect and physique. Three of them afterwards became kings of France. Francis, the eldest, was only 15 years old when he succeeded to the throne. He was devoted to his wife, Mary, Queen of Scots, and entrusted the government of the kingdom to her uncles, the Guises. From this time, the Reformation in France became a political as well as a religious movement. The Guises, coming from Lorraine, were looked upon as foreigners by the French nobility, though they were descended in the female line from René of Anjou. Claude, a younger son of René of Lorraine, had come to seek his fortune at the French court during the reign of Francis I, and had been treated with great favor by the king. Guise, Aumale, and Mayenne being erected into duchies for him. He died in 1550, and was succeeded as Duke of Guise by his son Francis, who won great popularity by his successful defense of Metz, 1552-3, and by the taking of Calais, 1558. A younger son, Charles, Cardinal of Lorraine, was a statesman of great ability and power, who controlled the government of the kingdom during the brief reign of his nephew. The Guises had always been firm supporters of the Pope, and in France they were leaders of the party opposed to the Reformation. On the other side were the Bourbons, the weak and unstable Antony, husband of Jeanne d'Albret and heir to the throne after the sons of Henry II, and his brother Louis, the Prince of Condé, a far more capable man who soon began to take the lead. With these were the three Châtillon brothers, Cardinal Odet de Châtillon, who as yet was only suspected of an inclination toward reform, Gaspard de Coligny, Admiral of France and the great man of his side, and Francis d'Andelot, an able supporter of his brother. Opposed to the Guises, but a staunch Catholic, was the constable, the stern and uncompromising Montmorency. Outside of all these parties was the Queen Mother, Catherine de Medici, 1519-89. Married at the age of 13 to a French prince who never cared for her, half despised by the nobility of France because of her origin, always kept in the background while her husband's favorite, Dionne of Poitiers, took her place. Yet possessed of an inordinate ambition and ever conscious of ability and power, this woman had an unfortunate and difficult position. The opportunity seemed to come with the death of her husband and the accession of her young son, but still she was deprived of authority by the Guises. Catherine has perhaps as bad a reputation as any woman in history. She was not actually immoral, but she was destitute of any moral sense. Under happier circumstances, she might have made a good ruler, but being unable to obtain power without scheming for it, she became crafty and intriguing. Ambitious and without principle, she followed the Machiavellian policy typical of the statesmen of her own land. The government of the Guises was not popular. The finances of the kingdom were in a serious condition. The war in Scotland against the lords of the Congregation was unsuccessful. The nobles of France were jealous of the family in power, and the question of resisting the severe religious persecution was discussed by the Huguenots, though it was sternly denounced by Calvin. In February 1560, the Seigneur de la Renaudie, a Protestant gentleman whose brother had been strangled without trial, formed a plot to arrest the Guises and place the king under the guardianship of the Bourbons. News of the plot leaked out, and the court was moved from Paris to Amboise. The enterprise failed. La Renaudie himself was slain in a skirmish, and many other conspirators were drowned or hanged, March 17, 1560. So strong was the feeling of discontent that even the Guises realized that some change in policy was necessary. Through the influence of Catherine de' Medici, Michel de l'Hôpital, a great lawyer and one of the most moderate men of his day, who thoroughly disapproved of persecution, was made chancellor. By the Edict of Romorantin, May 1560, liberty of conscience was permitted to the Protestants, though liberty of worship was still forbidden. At an assembly of the notables held in August, Admiral Coligny boldly stood forth as the champion of the Huguenots, and many other members advocated a cessation of persecution and a reform of the morals and discipline of the clergy. Rumors of another conspiracy, however, led to the arrest of Condé. The prince was tried and sentenced to execution, but he was saved by the sudden death of the young king, December 5, 1560, and the consequent end of the domination of the Guises. Charles IX, 1560-74, was only 10 years old, and Catherine de' Medici realized that her opportunity had at last arrived. The position of regent belonged by right to Antony of Bourbon, but he was easily bought off, and the office was occupied by the queen mother, who made Montmorency and Antony her chief advisers. Catherine hoped to be able to play off one party against the other, thus securing her own power. On December 13th, the Estates General, which had been summoned under Francis II, met at Orléans, and on January 28th an edict was issued ordering that all persecution should cease and admonishing the people to live in a Catholic manner for the future. The edict gave a considerable impulse to the Protestant movement and roused the wrath of stricter Roman Catholics. As a consequence, riots broke out, the Huguenots were mobbed, and they in return invaded churches and destroyed images and relics. Calvin wrote very strongly against such lawlessness. An edict of July 1561 forbade all meetings for worship conducted in any other manner than according to the rites of the Catholic Church, but relaxed the severity of the punishments for heresy. About the same time, a religious conference in which Protestants were invited was held at Poissy. The speech of Calvin's disciple, Theodore Beza, made a great impression. but the conference proved that no compromise between Catholics and Huguenots was possible. In January 1562, an attempt was made to secure toleration. For the first time, the Protestants were legally recognized, and they were allowed to assemble for public worship anywhere outside walled towns. This edict exasperated the Catholics and did not satisfy the Protestants. Montmorency had already joined the Guises, and the weak Antony of Bourbon was now won over. Disturbances broke out in different parts of the country, and civil war became imminent. B. The Wars of Religion, 1562-89. On Sunday, March 1st, 1562, the Duke of Guise was traveling from Joinville to Paris with his wife and children, his brother, the Cardinal of Guise, and about 200 armed gentlemen. As he rode through Vassy, he found a Huguenot service going on in a barn there. His followers hastened to disperse the worshippers, who made some resistance. Stones were thrown, and a fight followed, in which some 60 of the unarmed men and women were slain, and many were seriously wounded before the Duke could quell the tumult. The news of the massacre spread like wildfire. The extreme Catholics rejoiced, the regent and the chancellor were dismayed, and the Protestants were furiously indignant. The Guises entered Paris March 16th, and Catherine retired with the young king to Fontainebleau, inviting Condé to protect her and her children. Condé, however, allowed this opportunity to pass, and the regent was compelled by Antony of Bourbon to return to Paris, where she began definitely to side with the Romanists. Meanwhile, other massacres followed, and in retaliation, the Huguenots again invaded churches, destroying images and altars. Condé called the Protestant nobles together at Orléans, and the dreary period of civil wars, partly religious and partly political, began August 1562. The Huguenots were assisted by the German princes and Elizabeth of England, their opponents by the Pope and Philip II of Spain. In October, Rouen was taken by the Catholics, Antony of Bourbon dying of a wound received during the siege. In December, at the Battle of Dreux, where both parties claimed the victory, though the advantage lay with the Catholics, Condé was taken prisoner on the one side and Montmorency on the other. 2 months later, the Duke of Guise was assassinated by a fanatical Huguenot named Poltrot, February 24th, 1563, and Catherine de' Medici became the head of the Catholic Party. Terms of peace were now arranged by the Treaty of Amboise, March 1563. Condé and Montmorency were exchanged, and the Protestant services were permitted in the towns where they had been held before the war, Paris, however, being excepted. In June 1565, Catherine had a conference with Alva at Bayonne. This once more roused the fears of the Protestants, and when Alva began his policy of extermination in the Netherlands, they formed the Conspiracy of Meaux to get possession of the king's person, September 1567. The failure of this attempt led to the Second Civil War. In the indecisive Battle of Saint-Denis, November 10th, 1567, the constable Montmorency fell, and the command of the Catholic troops was given to the king's brother, Henry of Anjou. The Treaty of Longjumeau, which ended the war, March 1568, confirmed the terms of the Treaty of Amboise. The Catholics now made a great effort to inspire the people with enthusiasm for the Roman Church, while Catherine dismissed the tolerant L'Hôpital, and a plot was made to seize Condé and Coligny. These two leaders took refuge in La Rochelle, where they were joined by the heroic Jean d'Albret and her young son, Henry of Navarre, now only 15 years of age, but head of the Bourbon family. The course of the Third Civil War was unfortunate for the Huguenots. In March 1569, Henry of Anjou won the Battle of Jarnac, in which Condé was slain. The command now devolved upon Coligny, whose firmness and courage were never better displayed than in the hour of defeat. About this time the Protestants were assisted by William of Orange, and the Catholics by forces sent by the Duke of Alva, with the recommendation that Catherine should do in France as he had been doing in the Low Countries. At the Battle of Moncontour, October 1569, Coligny suffered a serious defeat, and if Anjou had followed up his victory, the Huguenots might have been crushed. As it was, time was wasted in besieging Saint-Jean d'Angély, which held out for 6 weeks, and Coligny, recovering from the wounds he had received at Moncontour, set out on a brilliant expedition across the south of France and up the Rhone. The Huguenots proved themselves ready to fight to the last, and the Peace of Saint-Germain, August 8, 1570, was more favorable to them than any previous one. They were allowed liberty of conscience, and were acknowledged as faithful subjects capable of holding office. They were permitted to hold their services as before arranged, and 4 strong places, La Rochelle, Montauban, Cognac, and La Charité, were given them as pledges for 2 years. End of section 27. Section 28 of The Renaissance and the Reformation by Emmeline Tanner. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 4, Chapter 17. The Wars of Religion in France and the Reign of Henry IV, Part 2. This treaty was followed by a change of policy in the French court. Catherine began to plan the marriage of her son Anjou with Elizabeth of England, and that of Margaret, her daughter, with the young King of Navarre. Each of these schemes involved the conciliation of the Huguenots. About this time, too, the young king seems to have shown a wish to conduct the government himself. He was jealous of his brother, the Duke of Anjou, and it may have been a desire for the real good of his country that made him long to break the connection with Spain. Coligny was now invited to court, where he soon acquired a great deal of influence. Henry of Navarre was betrothed to the king's sister Margaret, and plans were discussed for a great alliance between France, England, William the Silent, and the German Protestant princes. Elizabeth, however, was not willing to commit herself. Alençon was substituted for Anjou at the end of 1571, but still the English queen would not give a decisive answer. In April 1572, the sea beggars seized Brille, and Charles IX permitted Louis of Nassau to collect recruits from among the Huguenots of France, while Elizabeth allowed volunteers to go from England to the Netherlands. In the same year, a treaty was signed between England and France. Coligny seemed to be on the point of successfully carrying out his policy. Catherine de' Medici became alarmed at the growing influence of the admiral, whose greatness and statesmanship she recognized. But she was unable to take any active measures until after the marriage of her daughter with Henry of Navarre. The marriage took place on August 18, 1572, amid the rejoicings of the Protestants. On August 22, Coligny, when on his way home from an audience at the Louvre, was fired on from the window of a house belonging to a retainer of the Guises. The ball carried away a finger of one hand and broke the other arm, but did not otherwise injure the admiral. The Huguenots, who had collected in great numbers in the city to celebrate the wedding, were filled with consternation. The king turned pale on hearing the news and hastened to visit the wounded man, accompanied, however, by his mother, who on her return closeted herself with the Duke of Anjou to discuss further measures. The next day, August 23rd, Catherine held a council, at which an instant massacre of the Huguenots was decided upon, to which the unfortunate Charles was afterwards compelled by threats to give his consent. In the early morning of August 24th, 1572, St. Bartholomew's Day, the bell of Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois gave the signal that the hour had come. Other bells answered, and the massacre began. Bands of armed men wearing white crosses on their arms went through the streets of Paris, entering houses and slaying all the Huguenots. The Duke of Guise made himself responsible for the death of Coligny, the noblest spirit in France. The Protestants in the Louvre were slain on the stairs, in the halls, and in the courtyards. The two young Bourbon princes, Henry of Navarre and Henry of Condé, were spared, but were compelled to acknowledge themselves as Catholics. It is very possible that a massacre of the leaders only was intended, but when once the work of slaughter had begun, the mob could not be restrained. The fever spread to the provinces, and Sully, Henry IV's minister, declared that as many as 70,000 persons perished altogether. The news was variously received throughout Europe. The emperor strongly disapproved, and Elizabeth was righteously indignant, though she did not wish to break off the alliance with France in consequence. At Rome, a medal was struck to commemorate the event, and in Spain, Philip II is said to have laughed outright for the first and last time in his life. Charles IX never recovered from the shock of the massacre, and his death 2 years later may have been hastened by remorse. The Huguenots had lost their leaders, and their numbers were diminished, but they were more than ever determined to hold their own. An attempt to deprive them of their strongholds led to the Fourth Civil War, in which they resisted the most energetic efforts of their adversaries to recover La Rochelle. By the Treaty of La Rochelle, June 24, 1573, liberty of conscience was granted to all, but the right of public worship was permitted only in La Rochelle, Nîmes, Montauban, and in the houses of some of the principal Protestant nobles. Meanwhile, there grew up a third party, who realized the injury the civil wars were doing to their country. They were weary of strife, and longed for a peace to be established on the basis of mutual toleration. This party, which received the name of the Politique, was led by the Montmorencys, the two sons of the old constable, who had adopted the views of L'Hôpital. In March 1574, Charles IX died and was succeeded by his brother Henry of Anjou, who had been elected King of Poland in the previous year. Before the death of Charles, the Fifth Civil War had broken out. Henry III, 1574-89, fleeing from Poland, arrived in France in September, but no change of policy followed. The Duke of Anjou, the title taken by Alençon on his brother's accession, escaped from the court in September 1575 and joined the party of the Politique, who were then assisting the Huguenots under Condé. Henry of Navarre escaped in February 1576 and immediately afterwards renounced his forced adhesion to Romanism. The escape of the princes led to the ending of the war by the Peace of Monsieur, May 1576, in which the Huguenots obtained much better terms than hitherto. They were allowed to worship anywhere except within 2 leagues of Paris, or any town where the court happened to be residing. Chambers of justice composed partly of Protestants and partly of Catholics were established in each parlement. 8 strongholds were given to them as guarantees for the fulfillment of the treaty. In accordance with the wishes of the Allies, the king summoned the States General to meet at Blois in December. Contrary to expectation, the majority proved uncompromisingly hostile to the Huguenots, demanding the complete suppression of Protestant public worship and the banishment of all ministers, elders, and deacons. As a result, the Sixth Civil War broke out in 1577. It was ended by the Peace of Bergerac, September 17th. When the terms obtained by the Huguenots were not quite as good as those granted to them the previous year. They were, however, allowed the right of public worship in all places where it was exercised on the day of the treaty, Paris again being specially excepted. In 1580, a seventh war followed, but this was due to a personal quarrel concerning the dowry of Margaret between Henry III and Henry of Navarre, and not to religious disputes. It was ended by the Peace of Flesh, November 1580, which confirmed the Peace of Bergerac. It was hoped that the latter treaty had permanently solved the religious question, and that the two religions would be able to exist peaceably side by side. The Romanists, however, were little inclined to submit to the terms. Already various Catholic leagues had been formed in the provinces, and as early as 1576, the Duke of Guise appealed to all French Catholics to join in defense of the Church and of their king, Henry III, and to furnish themselves with arms for the accomplishment of their purpose. Henry III himself was enrolled a member. This was the beginning of the famous League. The death of the Duke of Anjou in June 1584 left the Protestant Henry of Navarre heir to the throne. The Romanists were determined never to acknowledge a Huguenot king. The Catholic League was constructed in its final form under the leadership of Henry, Duke of Guise, and his brothers, and the members resolved to proclaim the Cardinal of Bourbon as heir to the throne. At Joinville in January 1585, Philip of Spain joined the League. Meanwhile, the king acknowledged Henry of Navarre as his heir, and forbade the formation of any associations. He was, however, soon compelled to submit to the League, July 1585. The Pope published a bull against the King of Navarre and the Prince of Condé, July 1585, and soon after the Eighth War, the War of the Three Henrys broke out. It was a triangular contest, for although the weak and vicious king had submitted to the Guises, he resented their authority and their alliance with Spain, and inclined first to one policy and then to another. If Henry of Navarre would have become a Catholic, Henry III would have joined him, and the Guises might have been crushed and peace restored. But the Huguenot leader refused to abjure his faith. He won the Battle of Coutras, October 1587. But as the war continued, the Guises increased in power. Urged on by Philip II, they entered Paris to force the king to make new concessions, May 1588. Henry ordered his guards and the Swiss to hold the important points of the city. The citizens devoted to the Duke of Guise flew to arms and barricaded the streets. The king was compelled to ask Guise to interfere in order to save his soldiers. Henry could bear it no longer. He made one more effort to overthrow the League, and finding it unsuccessful, he invited Guise to the royal palace at Blois and treacherously ordered his assassination. December 23, 1588. The Cardinal of Guise was arrested and slain the next day. The Cardinal of Bourbon and the young son of the murdered duke were imprisoned. Paris was thrown into a state of the wildest excitement and indignation by the news of the assassination. The handsome, winning, chivalrous Henry of Guise had been the idol of the city, which at once organized itself to avenge his murder. The wretched king had no choice but to throw himself upon the mercy of Henry of Navarre. A treaty was made between the two kings, and the united forces were besieging Paris, when a fanatical monk, Jacques Clément, obtained access to Henry III's presence, stabbed him in the lower part of the body, August 1, 1589. The king died the next day after acknowledging Henry of Navarre as his heir and commending him to the nobles. His mother, Catherine de' Medici, had passed away in January amid the tumults that followed the death of Guise. See, the reign of Henry IV, 1589 to 1610. Henry of Navarre was now the legitimate king of France, but only a minority in his kingdom acknowledged his authority. The League was vigorously hostile, and the Huguenots enthusiastically loyal, but the moderate Catholics did not know what course to take. They hated Spain, and if Henry would have renounced his faith, they would willingly have accepted him as king, but this he refused to do. The position was one of great difficulty. The new king had many of the qualities that win popularity. He was a brave soldier and careless of danger, open-hearted and generous, gay and witty, possessing a great capacity for enjoyment. He was, nevertheless, ready cheerfully to endure hardships and privations. Henry now, August 4, 1589, published a declaration promising that Roman Catholicism should remain the religion of the land, and declaring himself willing to receive instruction in its teachings. The League, however, proclaimed the Cardinal of Bourbon king as Charles X. They were supported by Paris and nearly all the large towns and by Philip II. Henry felt that he was not yet strong enough to attack the capital. He marched to the west, therefore, where he could keep open his communications with England. In March 1590, with forces far inferior to those of his enemies, he defeated the army of the League under the Duke of Mayenne at Ivry. Probably, if he had pushed on at once, he might now have taken Paris by assault, but he chose a more cautious policy. In May he invested the city and had almost reduced it when Alexander of Parma led an army from the Netherlands to its relief and forced the king to retire. The death of Parma in 1592 removed Henry's most formidable opponent. Meanwhile, the Cardinal of Bourbon had died, May 1590, and the Leaguers had no legitimate king to put in his place. The more fanatical were willing to allow France to pass under the dominion of Spain, but to this the majority would not consent. Henry realized that no Huguenot sovereign would ever be accepted by the whole nation. He knew that the wars were ruining the land, and caring more for his country than for religion, he received instruction, and on July 23, 1593, was admitted into the Roman Catholic Church. In the following February, he was crowned at Chartres, Reims still being in the hands of the Guises, and in March he entered Paris, receiving a welcome that was unexpectedly enthusiastic. Some of the Leaguers still held out, but all eventually came to terms. War was openly declared against Spain in 1595, and peace was not made till 1598, when at the Peace of Vervins, May 2nd, the terms of the Treaty of Cateau-Cambrésis were confirmed. Spain evacuating all the conquests she had made during the last war, with the exception of Cambrai, and Henry restoring the county of Charolais. 3 years later, in 1601, Henry exchanged Saluzzo with the Duke of Savoy for Bresse, Bugey, and Gex. A month before the conclusion of peace with Spain, Henry had settled the religious question in France by the publication of the famous Edict of Nantes, April 15, 1598, whereby 1. The Huguenots obtained liberty of conscience and the right to the exercise of their religion in all places where it had been celebrated during the two preceding years, and in addition, in one town in each official district in France and in the principal castles of Protestant nobles. 2. The Huguenots were to be admitted to all schools and colleges and to all offices. 3. Special chambers were established in the Parlement to try cases in which Protestants were concerned. 4. The Huguenots were to renounce all foreign alliances. 5. As a guarantee for the fulfillment of these terms, a number of towns, including the strongholds of La Rochelle, Montauban, and Nîmes, were granted to them for 8 years. The position of the Protestant minority was thus secured, but the creation of a state within a state was a political mistake and led to renewed trouble later. Henry now set himself to restore order and prosperity to his almost ruined country, which for 40 years had been the scene of strife and disorder. His success was in part due to the cooperation of his able minister Sully, Marquis of Rosny. The finances of the kingdom were in a terrible condition, and the taxable value of the people was at its lowest, but Henry and Sully were not to be discouraged. Every effort was made to develop the material prosperity of the kingdom. Marshy land was drained and cultivated, rivers were made navigable, roads and bridges improved, agriculture encouraged, manufactures fostered, commerce promoted, and the efforts of colonizers like Champlain seconded. Royal domains were recovered, sinecure offices swept away, and the system of collecting taxes improved. At the same time, the greatest economy was exercised in expenditure. Henry found France on the verge of ruin. He left her prosperous. Politically, no advance was made during the reign. The country needed a strong ruler, and the people were only too ready to leave the government to a king who combined strength and power with a real desire for the nation's good. Henry IV laid the foundations for the greatness of France in the 17th century. It is true that the increase in the absolute power of the monarch was one of the chief causes of the miseries which eventually led to the revolution. But when Henry became king, no other form of government was possible for France. In foreign policy, Henry's chief aim was to weaken the Habsburgs. In May 1610, with that end in view, he was preparing to aid the Protestant princes of Germany when he was assassinated in the streets of Paris by a Roman Catholic named François Ravaillac. He was killed instantly. The assassin believed that his act would be welcome to the people of France. The execration with which it was received throughout the kingdom surprised and disappointed him. The enemies of France rejoiced, but the French people united as one man to deplore the loss of the most human and sympathetic of French kings. End of section 28. Read by Pamela Nagami, M.D. in Encino, California, July 2024. End of The Renaissance and the Reformation, a textbook of European history, 1494 to 1610, by Emmeline Tanner.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.